with anti-tank weapons. I want 2 full-strength troop assaults pushing ahead into the south of the town here. Collier? Baffles? That's you. Around the warehouse barns. He pointed to his chart. Here's the winner. A side thrust. Maybe 4 or 5 tanks. In from the east, with infantry support and the salamanders. Objective is the temple, and then pushing through to the fuel stores. Hydra batteries will slug down from the road line here. What about civilians? Asked Hark. I haven't brought any. Have you? The men laughed. Bhavnagar is a clear and open target. I'll say it now, so there's no mistake about it. We prosecute this town with maximum prejudice. Even if there are civilians. There are no civilians. Understood? The officers assented quickly. Gaunt ignored Kurth's dark look. Cleopas, you have command of the main charge. I'll bring the ghosts in behind you. Rorn, Cyrus, you have the side thrust. Val, I want you to play watchdog with a platoon on the road. Stay behind the Hydras and cover the transport and supply train. Bring them in only when we signal the town as secure. Go word is Slado. Support advance is Oktar. Retreat command is Dersius. Vox channel is Beta Kappa Alpha. Secondary is Kappa Beta Beta. Any questions? There were none. With under 2 hours of daylight left, sunset burning off the mountains and rain on the wind, the honor guard fell upon Bhavnagar. Le Guin's Grey Venger and the company's other destroyer, the name Death Jester painted in crimson on its plating skirts, went in first along the highway, cleaning off the outer perimeter. Between them, they made 8 kills, all in Fardy MBTs, covering the fruit groves on the road. McColl led a scout platoon in with them. They rode on the destroyer's hulls until they reached the tree cover, and then scattered into the spinnies. The ghosts rolled forward in a wave alongside the hunting tank killers, locating and cutting the observation posts of the enemy signal line by stealth. Venger and Jester bellied down at the edge of the trees, overlooking Bhavnagar, as the main assault force swooped in past them, the Heart of Destruction leading the way. The ground shook, and mechanical thunder rolled through the still air. Troops dismounted in full strength from the trucks behind them, and then the transporters retreated to waymark 00.60, where Val and his unit guarded the Chimeras, Trojans, and tankers. The word was given, and the word was Slado. Under Cleopas, 12 battle machines charged towards Bhavnagar from the south. 11 conquerors and the company's single executioner, an ancient plasma tank, nicknamed Strife. By then, the enemy had seen the smoke and flash of the destroyer kills in the woods and had launched out in force. 32 AT-70 Reavers, all painted gloss lime, plus 7 model N-20 half-tracks, mounting 70mm anti-tank cannons. Major Cleopas considered ruefully that this was considerably more than Captain Cyrus's estimate of at least 10 Reavers and 5 self-propelled guns. This was going to be a major engagement. A chance to snatch glory from the din of battle. A chance to find death, the sort of choice the Pardus were bred to make. Despite the appalling odds, Cleopas grinned to himself. The Imperial Hydras dug in and locked out, sprayed their drizzle of rapid fire over the town from the tree line. 2,000 ghosts fanned out over the open approach in the wake of Cleopas's charging armored cavalry. Already, small arms fire was cracking at them from the town edge. The tank fight began in earnest. Cleopas's squadron was formed in a trailing V with the Heart of Destruction at the tip. They had the slight advantage of incline in the cleared ground between the fruit groves and the town edge, and were making better than 30 kph. The enemy mass, in no ordered formation, churned up the slope to meet them, kicking rock chips and dry soil out behind them as their tracks dug in. They played out in a long, uneven line. In the command seat of the Heart, Cleopas checked the readings of his auspecs, glowing pale yellow in the half-light of the locked-down turret, against the eyeball view through his prismatic upscope. He used his good right eye for this, not his augmetic implant, an affectation his crew often joked about. Cleopas then adjusted his padded leather headset and flicked down the wire stalk of the voice mic.
Lay on, and fire at will!
The Conqueror phalanx began to fire, a dozen main weapons blasting and then blasting again. Bright balls of gas flame flashed from their muzzles, and discharge smoke streamed back from their muzzle brakes, fuming in long white trails of slipstream over their hulls. 3 AT-70s sustained direct hits and vanished in flurries of metal and fire. 2 more were crippled and foundered, beginning to burn. A half-track lurched lengthways as a round from the Conqueror Man of Steel punched through its crew bay and shredded it like a mess tin, hit by a las shot. The elderly Pardus executioner tank Strife, commanded by Lieutenant Pauk, was slower on its treads than the dashing Conqueror's and trailed at the end of the left-hand file. Its stubby, outsized plasma cannon raised a gleaming red spear of destruction down the slope and explosively sheared the turret off an AT-70 in a splash of shrapnel and spraying oil. The enemy mass began firing back uphill with resolved fury. The main weapons of the AT-70s were longer and slimmer than the hefty muzzles of the Imperial Conquerors. Their blasts made higher, shrieking roars and sparked star-shaped gas burns from the flash retarders at the end of their barrels. Shells rained down across the Imperial charge. Le Guin had been right. Examples of old sub-Imperial standard technology. The Reavers lacked any Auspex guidance or laser range-finding. It was also clear they had no gyro-stabilizers. Once the Conqueror guns were aimed, they damn well stayed aim-locked, thanks to inertial dampers, no matter how much bouncing and lurching the tank was experiencing. That meant the Conquerors could shoot and move simultaneously without any appreciable loss of target lock. The AT-70s fired by eye, and any movement or jarring required immediate aim revision. In the heart of destruction, Cleopas smiled contentedly. The enemy was chucking hundreds of kilos of munitions up the slope at them, but most of it was going wide or overshooting. They were not designed for efficient mobile shooting. If their Supremo had only had the good sense to stop his armor dead and fire on the Imperial charge from stationary locks, he would have been ahead on points by now. Even so, more by luck than judgment, the enemy scored hits. The Conqueror, known as Mighty Smiter, was hit simultaneously by two rounds from different adversaries, exploded, and slewed to an ugly halt, greasy black smoke pouring out of the hatches. Drumroll, another Conqueror, under the command of Captain Hancott, was hit in the starboard tread section and lost its tracks in a shower of sparks and steel fragments. It lurched and came to a stop, but continued to fire. Captain André Wall made his second kill of the day, and his crew let out a cheer. Wall was a tank ace, adored by the Pardus regiment, and Cyrus's chief rival. Under the stencil reading Old Strontium on the side of his steed was a line of 61 kill marks. Cyrus and the Wrath of Padua claimed 69. Electric servos swung Old Strontium's turret basket around, and Wall executed a perfect kill on a veering AT-70. The noise in the Conqueror turret was immense, despite the sound lagging and the crew's ear protectors. When it fired, the breech of the main gun hurtled back into the turret space with 190 tons of recoil force. The novice loaders and gun layers at Pardus boot camp quickly trained themselves to be alert and nimble. As the breech slammed back, a battered metal slide funneled the red-hot spent shell case into the cartridge hopper, and the loader swung round with a fresh shell from the water-jacketed magazine, thumping it into place with the ball of his palm. The layer consulted the rangefinder and the crosswind sensor and obeyed Wall's Auspex-guided instructions. Wall always kept one eye on the target reticule displayed on his upscope. Like all good soldiers, he only trusted tech data so far.
"Target at 11.34," Wall instructed.
"11.34, aye,"
the layer repeated, jerking the recoil brake. The gun roared. Another Reaver was reduced to a rapidly expanding ball of fire and scrap. The Pardus armor men were trained for mobile cut and thrust. The Conqueror's time-honored torsion bar suspension systems and high power-to-weight ratio meant they were more nimble than most of the adversaries they encountered, whether super-heavy monsters or lackluster mediums like the ones the Infardi were fielding. That meant the Conquerors were perfect cavalry tanks, built to fight on the move, to charge, to outmaneuver and overwhelm the foe. But there came a crucial moment in any armor cav charge where the decision had to be made to halt, break, or break through. Cleopas knew that moment was at hand. The dream intention of any armor charge was to utterly crush the target formation, but the Infardi outnumbered them 3-1, and more tanks were massing at the edge of the town. Cleopas cursed. The Infardi had mustered in division strength at Bavnaga. The Major had to keep revising Cyrus's original estimate up and up. Forget about major engagement. This was becoming historic. The Conquerors were about to meet the enemy head-on. Cleopas had three choices. Stop dead and fight it out standing, break through the enemy line and turn to finish the job, or separate and pincer. A stand-up fight was a worst-case option. It would allow the Reavers to play to their strengths. Breakthrough was psychologically strong, but it meant reversing the playing field, and the Pardus would then be fighting back uphill, risking their own infantry coming in behind.
Pincer, 3-4, pincer, now!
Cleopas instructed his squadron. The left-hand edge of the V formation carried on with Cleopas at the head, crashing past and between the Infadi machines. The right edge, under Wall, spread wide in a lateral line and slowed right down. Gearboxes and differentials grinding, the tanks of Cleopas's wing rotated almost on a point, spraying up loose earth and presented at the hindquarters of the enemy line. All Leman Russ pattern tanks, like the Conqueror's, delivered deliciously low ground pressure through their track arrangement and possessed fine regenerative steering. These almost balletic turns were a trademark move. Six more AT-70s blew out as they were struck from the rear, and two more and a half-track fell to Wall's straggler line. The sloping field south of Bavnaga became a tank graveyard. Flames and debris covered the ground, and burning wrecks littered the incline. Huddles of Infadi crew, ejected from escape hatches, ran blindly for cover. Some of the Reavers, lurching on their old-style volute spring suspension, tried to come about to engage Cleopas's line, and were blown apart from both sides. The front formation of the Infadi armor was overrun and slaughtered. But the day was nothing like one yet. The Man of Steel shuddered and lost its front end in a spurting fireball. From the edge of the town, an N-20 half-track, sensibly bedded down and unmoving, had hit it squarely with its anti-tank cannon. Cleopas blanched as he heard Captain Ridas screaming over the Voxnet as fire swamped his turret basket. Moments later, the Conqueror, Pride of Memphis, was destroyed by a traversing AT-70. Plasma spitting out with searing brilliance, Lieutenant Polk's Strife evened the score. As Cleopas's tanks hauled around on their regenerative steering again, Wall's line came through the killfield, crunching and rolling over enemy wrecks. 18 more AT-70s were spread around the town's southern limits and were bombarding steadily from standing. The shell deluge was apocalyptic. Wall counted 9 usurper-pattern self-propelled guns firing from positions behind the AT-70 front. The boxy usurpers carried howitzers, crude but efficient copies of Imperial Earthshakers, slanting forward out of their gun pulpits. Behind them came 12 more N-20s, moving in a file down the marketplace road. It was going to get worse before it got better.
"Line up! Line up!"
Gaunt cried, and his call was repeated down the infantry file from platoon leader to platoon leader. The Ghosts had formed in position at the edge of the tree line, behind the 4 rattling Hydra batteries, and had been watching in awe and admiration for the last 10 minutes as the tank fight boiled across the approach field below.
"Men of Tanith! Warriors of Vagast! Now we do the Emperor's duty! Advance! By file! Advance!"
Starting to jog, and then to run, the massed force of Ghosts came down the field, through the blasted landscape, bayonets fixed. A few shells dropped amongst them. Glaring tracers spat overhead. The air was filthy with smoke. Collier led the left-hand point of the advance, Sergeant Baffles the right, with Gaunt somewhere between them. Gaunt allowed his designated assault leaders to move ahead, confident in their abilities, while he took time to pause and turn to yell encouragement and inspiration to the hundreds of troopers streaming down the slope. He brandished his power sword high so they could see it. Right then, he missed Bryn Milo. Bryn should be here, he thought, piping the Ghosts into battle. He yelled again, his voice almost hoarse. Commissar Hark was advancing with Baffles' mob. His shouts and urgings lacked the rousing fire of Gaunt's. He was new to them. He hadn't shared what Gaunt had shared with them. Still, he urged them on.
"Destroyers signaled their advance in our support,"
Vox Officer Beltane reported to Gaunt as they ran forward. Gaunt looked back to see the Grey Venger and the Death Jester rise up on their torsion springs and begin to prowl in at the heels of the infantry. It made a change to advance under armor, Gaunt thought. This was the Imperial Guard at its most efficient. This was inter-speciality cooperation. This was victorious assault. Anna Kurth and the medical party pushed down in the wake of the charging Ghosts. The ground they were covering was ruined by the furious tank fight and stank of fuel and physoline. Shells had torn it up, so that the chalky bedrock was ploughed up over the black topsoil in white curds and lumps. It looked to Kurth as if the very entrails of the earth had been blown out and exposed. This was a dead landscape, and they would undoubtedly extend and enlarge it before they were finished with Bavnaga. Lesp darted to the left as a Ghost went down. Another 2 fell to an overshot tank round immediately ahead, and Chaker and Foskin ran forward.
Medic! Medic!
The scream rose from the massed confusion of manpower before her.
I have it!
Matane called to her, scrambling over the broken ground to a ghost who was hunched over a squealing, disemboweled friend. This is hell, Kurth thought. It was her first taste of open war, of full-scale battle. She'd been through the urban horrors of Vervenhive, but had only ever read about the experience of pitched war in exposed territory, battlefields. Now she understood what the term meant. It took a lot to shock Anna Kurth, and death and injury wasn't enough. What shocked her here was the raging, callous fury of the battle. The scale, the size, the gack-awful noise, the mass charge, the mass wounding, the randomness of pain and hurt.
Medic!
She pulled open her field kit, running forward between the plumes of fire kicked up by falling shells and heavy lasfire. Every time she thought she knew the horrors of war, it gleefully exposed new ones. She wondered how men like Gaunt could be even remotely sane after a life of this.
Medic!
I'm here. Stay down. I'm here.
From Waymark 07.07, the side thrust began their assault. They congregated a kilometer to the east of Bavnaga at an outlying farm. Even from this distance, the thunder of the main assault 4 kilometers away was shaking the ground. Rawn spat in the dust and picked up the las rifle he had leant against the farmyard's dry brick perimeter wall.
Time to go, he said.
Captain Cyrus nodded and ran back towards his waiting tank, one of 6 conquerors idling behind the abandoned farmstead. Fagor, Rawn's adjutant, armed his las gun and roused up the troops, close on 300 ghosts. The wind was up and the sun setting. Gold light radiated from the bulbous stupa of the temple 1 kilometer away. Rawn adjusted his vox.
3 to Cyrus. You see what I see?
I see the eastern flank of Bavnaga. I see the temple.
Good. If you're ready.
Go!
The 6 conquerors roared out of their holding position and charged across the open fields and meadows towards the eastern edge of the town. Behind them came the convoy's 8 remaining salamanders. Rawn hopped up onto the running boards of one of the command salamanders and rode it in, turning back to supervise the infantry group advancing behind him. The 5 conquerors chasing Cyrus's Wrath of Padua were named Say Your Prayers, Fancy Clara, Steel Storm, Lucky Bastard, and Lion of Padua, the latter the Wrath's sister tank. Rocking over terrain humps and irrigation gullies, the Pardus machines began firing, their shots hammering at the looming temple and its precincts. Puffs of white smoke plumed from the distant hits, silently. Almost immediately, 4 AT-70 tanks appeared around the northern side of the temple. 2 spurred forward into the edges of the wet arable land, the others stopped dead and commenced shelling. The Fancy Clara, commanded by Lieutenant Latour, crippled one of the moving tanks with a beautiful long-range shot that would have made Wall himself proud. But then, as it bounced up over a tilled field, a tungsten-cored tank round hit the Clara squarely, penetrating the turret mantle and puncturing down through the basket. Latour lost his right arm, and his gun layer was instantly liquidized. The incandescent shell pierced the water jackets of the Clara's magazine and didn't explode. The Conqueror swerved to a halt. Latour was numb with shock. He could barely pull aside his seat harness to look round. The interior of the turret was painted with a slick film of gore, the only remaining physical trace of his lair. The loader had fallen from his metal stool and was curled fetally on the floor of the basket, drenched in blood.
"Holy Emperor,"
Latour murmured, looking down through the crisp-edged hole in the side of the magazine. Filthy water from the jackets dribbled out, diluting the blood on the floor. He could see sizzling fire inside the hole, the heat shock residue of the impact.
"Get out!"
he cried. The loader looked blank, shocked out of his mind.
"Get out!"
Latour repeated, reaching for the escape hatch pull with an arm that was no longer there. Laughing at the macabre oddness of it, he swung around and reached up with his remaining hand. He heard the driver scrambling out through the forward hatch. With a pop, heat exchanger conduits in the side of the turret, weakened by the shell impact, burst. Scalding water spurted out, hitting Latour in the face before cascading down to broil his loader. Latour tried to scream. The loader's shrieks echoed around the tank interior. The shell had severed electrical cables in the footwell of the turret. The swirling water met the fizzling ends. Latour and his loader were electrocuted, even as they writhed and screamed and blistered. Targeting a stationary AT-70, the Steel Storm exchanged shot after shot with it. Lieutenant Hellier, commanding the Steel Storm, realized his inertial dampers were damaged and that his Auspex must consequently be out. He shut the electronic systems down and began to aim through the reticule of the upscope. He called out lay numbers to his aimer and was about to make a confident kill when the tank exploded, flipped over, and broke apart. The steel storm had hit the edge of the so far undetected minefield east of Bavnaga. The Wrath of Padua crossed into the field immediately behind it, losing track pins and part of its side plating to an exploding mine. Gunning its drive into full reverse, it was able to limp backwards a few meters while Cyrus called an urgent dead stop. The three remaining conquerors slewed up behind him. Bouncing up to their rear, the salamander formations drew out in a line abreast, the infantry herding in around them. Shells from the three AT-70s on the far side of the minefield splashed all around them, chewing up the muddy irrigation system of the farmland, which had already been scored with deep furrows by the hurtling armor.
"Sweepers! Sweepers forward!"
Rawn ordered into his vox. Two specialist squads of three, one led by Shoggy Domor, the other by a Vergastite trooper named Burone, immediately went ahead under fire.
"Infantry units, support!"
Rawn yelled. The ghosts began firing at the edge of the town with las rifles, and with the heavier infantry support weapons they had brought up. Four heavy stubbers and three missile launchers, plus the heavy bolters and the autocannons hull-mounted on the salamanders. The sweeper squads were miserably exposed, working their delicate magic as tank rounds and small arms fire whooshed around them. They had the expertise to clear a corridor through the field, if they lived long enough. The second front advance was now dangerously delayed. More AT-70s appeared in support of the existing trio, as well as a quartet of heavy usurper self-propelleds. Cyrus wondered just how much bloody armor the enemy had to draw on at Bavnaga. Deadlocked by the mines, the four conquerors began free-firing at the enemy position with main guns and coaxial mounts. In the space of a few seconds, the Lion of Padua comprehensively destroyed a self-propelled gun thoroughly enough to ignite its munition pile, and the lucky bastard knocked out an AT-70. The detonation of the self-propelled gun was severe enough to spray shrapnel out over the minefield and trigger a few of the buried munitions off. The Say Your Prayers and Cyrus's Wrath of Padua slung over some tank rounds that blew out the north retaining wall of the temple. The Wrath's driver and a Pardus tech priest from the Salamanders took the opportunity to rig running repairs on the Conqueror's damaged track section. In a shell-dug foxhole near to Rawn's Salamander, Creed, Caffran, and McKillian prepped one of the foot-support missile launchers, known as tread feathers in the regimental slang. It was a shoulder tube of khaki-painted metal with a foroscope, a trigger brace, and fluted venturi at the back end to vent the recoil exhaust. Heavy support weapons like this weren't commonly deployed by the stealth specialist ghosts. In fact, Bragg was often the only trooper carrying one. But they were in the middle of a tank fight now. Caffran shouldered the tube and aimed via the crude wire crosshairs at the AT-70 that had dueled with the late, lamented Steel Storm. Like many ghosts, Caffran had become familiar with tread feathers during the street-to-street war at Vervenhive, where he'd used one to knock out five Zoikan siege tanks. In fact, he'd been fielding one in the burning Habs when Creed had turned up to save his life from Zoikan stormtroops. They'd been together ever since. Over the roar of the fighting, he heard her say, "For Vergast," as she kissed the armed rocket grenade McKillian handed to her. She slammed it into the launcher pipe.
"Loaded!"
she yelled. Caffran had his target.
"Ease!"
he ordered. Everybody nearby echoed the word so that their mouths would be open when the tube fired. Anyone with closed mouths risked burst eardrums from the sudden firing pressure. With a hollow, whistling cough, the tread feather shot the rocket grenade at the enemy, leaving a slowly dissolving contrail of smoke behind it. The hit was clean, but the rocket exploded impotently off the heavy front armor of the Reaver. As if goaded, the AT-70 came around.
"Load me! Loaded!" Creed yelled. "Ease!"
Now that was better. The AT-70 shuddered and began to burn. Its cannon muzzle drooped, as if the tank itself was feigning death.
"Load me, just to be sure! Loaded! Ease!"
The burning AT-70 now shivered and exploded in a blizzard of machine parts, armor plating, track segments, and fire. A cheer rippled down the infantry lines. Then, above the ceaseless warring, the sound of another, louder cheer. Rawn leapt out of his salamander to investigate, running hunched as tracer fire crackled over his position. Larkin had scored magnificently with his first shot of the engagement.
"I saw it for definite,"
Trooper Koo told Rawn excitedly, tapping his lasgun scope.
"Lark's got the officer, dead as dead."
At a distance of over 300 meters, Larkin had put a hot-shot las round through the sighting grill of the pulpit armor on one of the usurpers and killed the artillery officer in charge. It was one hell of a shot.
"You go, Lark's!"
Trooper Nescon yelled.
One of the unit's flame troopers, Nescon, was reduced to firing his las pistol, his flame gun pretty much redundant in these mid-to-long-range conditions.
"Could you do better closer?" Rowan asked Larkin.
"I'd feel better further away, Major. Like on another planet, maybe,"
Larkin said sourly.
"I'm sure, but..."
"Yes, of course, sir,"
Larkin said.
"Follow Domor's team out into the field. Fagor, form up a 5-man intruder team around Larkin. Get another sniper in there if you can. Move out down the swept corridor and give the sweeper boys cover. Use the reduced range to do some real damage. I want officers and commanders picked out and killed."
"Don't we all, Major?"
replied Fagor, as he leapt up to obey. The voice of Rowan's adjutant had always been deep and gravelly, but ever since the final fight for Vervaire Gate, he'd spoken through a voice box deformed and twisted with Lasburn scar tissue. He was permanently monotone and deadpan. Fagor scrabbled around and selected Koo, Bander, and the Vergast sniper Twenish to accompany himself and Larkin. Under the storm of fire, the quintet moved out into the killing field. Domor's party, working alongside Burone's, had cleared a 10-meter-wide channel that ran 30 meters into the field, its edges carefully denoted by staked tapes laid by Trooper Memo. One of Burone's squad was already dead, and McCaw, in Domor's, had taken shrapnel in his left thigh and shoulder. Domor's team was slightly ahead of Burone's, and this competition was a matter of pride between Tanith and Vergastite minesweepers. Domor, of course, had the advantage of his heat-reading augmetic eyes to back up the sweeper brooms. Fagor's intruder team joined them, Larkin and Twenish immediately digging in and sighting up as Koo and Bander gave them cover fire. The vulnerable sweepers were glad of the additional support.
"Couldn't have brought a fat stub or a tread feather with you, I suppose?" Domor asked. "Just keep sweeping, Shoggy," Fagor growled.
Twenish was a damn good shot, Larkin noted. He was one of the very few Vergastite newcomers to have specialized in sniper school before the Act of Consolation. A long-limbed, humorless fellow, Twenish was ex-Vervan Primary, a career soldier. His long las was newer than Larkin's gnarlwood-furnished beauty. With a grotesquely enlarged nightscope array, a bipod stand, and a ceramide stock individually tailored to fit its user. The two snipers, products of entirely diverging regimental schools and training, began firing at the enemy armor. From 3 shots, Larkin dropped a usurper gunlayer, an infantry leader, and the commander of an AT-70 who had made the mistake of spotting from his turret hatch. Twenish fired in quick double shots. If the first didn't kill, it at least found range and drew his aim to his target for the second. From 3 of these paired shots, he made 2 excellent kills, including an Infadi priest rousing his men to combat. But to Larkin, it seemed like wasted effort. He knew about the double-shot method, and also was aware that many guard regiments taught the approach as standard. In his opinion, it gave the enemy too much warning, no matter how quickly you adjusted for the second squeeze. As he lined up again, Larkin began to find the crack-paws crack of Twenish's routine off-putting. Twenish was obsessive in his care, laying out a sheet of visicloth beside his firing position that he used to polish clean the scope lenses between each double shot, like a fething machine. Crack, pause, crack, polish, polish, crack, pause, crack. Enough with the precious rituals, Larkin felt like yelling, though he had more than enough of his own. Larkin snuggled in again and with 1 shot killed the driver of a half-track that was moving into the opposition line. Bander, Koo, and Fagor knelt in the folds of soil, blazing, suppressing fire freely at the enemy. Bander was an excellent shot, and like many of her kind, female Vergastite conscripts that was, she had wanted to specialize in marksmanship on joining the Ghosts. As it was, there was a strict limit on numbers for that specialization, and she'd been denied, although, to Bander's delight, her friend Nessa had made it. Most of the marksman places went to Vervan primary snipers like Twenish, who were carrying their specialization over into the Ghosts with them. But Bander could shoot damn well, even with a standard bulk-stamped las rifle, a fact she'd proved to the gackass Major Rawn in the Universitariat clearance. A swathe of autogun fire rippled across the position of the sweepers and the intruder team, and everyone threw themselves down. The remaining member of Baroni's team was shredded, and Baroni himself was hit in the hip. As they all got up again, Bander was first to realize that Twenish was dead, hammered into the soil in his prone position by the stitching fire that had raked over them. Without hesitating, she leapt forward and prized the Vergastite long las from Twenish's stiff grip.
"Do you know what you're doing?" Larkin called to her.
"Yes, get you very much, Mr. Tanith Sniper."
She took aim. The stock, molded for Twenish's longer reach, was awkward for her, but she persisted. This was a long las, gack it. No double shots for her. An Infadi artillery officer running from one usurper to the other crossed her sighting reticule, and she blew his head off.
Nice,
approved Larkin. Banda smiled, and took an Infadi gunman off the balustrade of the temple at 400 meters.
Beat you at your own game, Lax,
Koo simpered at Larkin.
Sure as sure.
Feth off, said Larkin. He knew how brilliantly, if psychotically, Koo could shoot. If Koo wanted a piece of it, let him get his belly dirty and use the damn long lads. At least Banda was eager, and damn good. He'd always suspected that about her, since the day he'd first met her at Street Junction 281KL in the suburbs of Vervenhive. The cheeky, fething bitch. As Domor's squad continued forward with their unenviably deadly task, and a fresh sweeper team ran forward to replace Buroni's unit, the two ghost snipers plied their precise and murderous trade across the enemy positions.
3-1! We're deadlocked,
Rawn told Gaunt via his salamander's powerful voxcaster set.
How long, 3?
At this rate, an hour before we're even at the temple, 1.
Continue as you are, and await orders.
South of Bavnaga, the infantry forces were swarming into the town itself on the smoking heels of the Pardus main armor. Tanks were engaging the enemy at short range now, in the limiting spaces of the narrow market area streets. Wall's old Strontium knocked out 3 N-20 anti-tankers during this phase of close armor, and hit a usurper before it could train its huge tank-killing weapon down to fire. Cleopas's Heart of Destruction was caught in a firefight with 2 Reavers, and the Conqueror's Xenophobe and Tread Softly smashed down local coral walls and single-story brick-built houses as they moved up to support it. The Executioner Tank Strife, flanked by the Conqueror's Beat the Retreat and P-48J, crushed a squadron of half-tracks and broke into the compound of the southwestern produce barns. Collier's Troop Spearhead swiftly moved up to support them, enduring a series of fierce, close-range fights through the echoing interiors of the barns. McCall's scout force pushed through towards the town center marketplace after an ambiguous but deadly confrontation in the yards of the warehouses where bales of dried vines were stacked. A platoon under Corporal Merrin fought their way in after them, meeting a counterassault massed by 50 Infadi gunmen. The flame troopers, typified by Brostin and Dremond and the Vagastite Lubber, excelled themselves during this part of the fight, sweeping clean the hard-locked barns of any Infadi resistance. Accompanied by Vox officer Beltane, Gaunt advanced through the Promethium smoke and the Physalene discharge. He took the handset from Beltane as it was offered.
1-7. 7-1,
Sergeant Baffles replied, his voice eerily distorted by electromagnetics.
3's counterpunch is deadlocked. We need to secure the fuel depot stat. I want you to push ahead and cut us a way through. How do you feel about that?
Do our best, 1.
1-7. Acknowledged.
Sergeant Baffles turned to his prong of the advance as heavy shelling whipped over them.
"Orders just got interesting, people," he said.
They groaned.
"What the gack are we expected to do now, Baffles?"
asked Sorek.
"Simple," said Baffles. "Live or die. The fuel depot. Let's look like we mean business."
At waymark 00.60, standing amid the parked tankers, chimeras, Trojans, and troop trucks, they could hear the rumble of battle from away through the trees at Bavnaga. Val's defense section stood about aimlessly, talking with the waiting Munitorium drivers, smoking, cleaning kit. Val paced up and down. He so fething wanted to get down there, and into it. This was a good duty and all, but still.
Sir?
Val looked round. Trooper Unkin was approaching.
Trooper?
He says he wants to advance.
Who does?
Him, sir.
Unkin pointed at the ragged old Ayatani, Zweil.
I'll deal,
Val told his point man. He wandered down to the old priest.
You have to stay here, father, he said.
I have to do no such thing,
Zweil replied.
In fact, it's my duty to get down there on the path of the Iolta Ahmad Infardiri.
The what, father?
The Pilgrim's Way. There are pilgrims in need of my ministry.
There's no such...
A distant, powerful explosion shook the air.
I'm going, Sergeant Val, right now. To do less would be desecration.
Val groaned as the elderly priest strode away from him and began heading down the highway through the fruit groves towards Bavnaga. Gaunt would have Val's stripes if anything happened to the Ayatani.
Take over,
Val told Unkin, and began running after the retreating figure of the priest.
Father! Father's Zweil! Wait up!
Caustic smoke was rolling down the length of the side street, obscuring Collier's view. Somewhere down there. Somewhere close to the point where the street met the main through road just off the market square, an enemy half-track was sitting and chopping fire from its pintle mount at anything that moved. Every now and then it fired its anti-tank gun, too. The wretched smoke was pouring out of a threshing mill close by. Lasfire whimpered down the thoroughfare. The tightly packed buildings in the side street degraded fox quality. It reminded Collier rather too much of the fighting in the outhabs of Vervenhive. Corporal Merrin's platoon, fresh from their firefight in the barns, moved up behind Collier's bunch. Collier signaled Merrin by hand to force a way through the buildings to the left and out onto the street, running parallel to the one that currently stymied the advance. Merrin acknowledged. Bonin, one of the scouts, had peeled to the right and found a walk-through breezeway that opened onto a small area of open wasteland behind the street buildings. Hearing this over the vox, Collier immediately sent Venar, Huelne, Fenix, and Jajo through to link up with Bonin. Fenix carried a tread feather in addition to his las rifle. From cover, Collier continued to scrutinize the billowing smoke for signs of the gacking N-20. After a while, he began to fire off rounds into the section of smoke his instinct said concealed it. He was sure he could hear his shots impacting off hull metal. A heavy burst of stub fire raked back in response, chewing into the rubble and debris on the street. Almost immediately, it was followed by a whistling bang as the anti-tank weapon fired. The shell, traveling, it seemed to Collier, at head height, impacted explosively in a burnt-out hut behind Collier's position. As it sped through the smoke, the projectile left behind a bizarre corkscrew wake pattern.
"Come forward. Come forward, you bastard,"
Collier urged the track under his breath.
"Confirmed foot targets,"
the vox hiss came in his ear. Marksman Rilke, dug into cover close by Collier, had seen movement down by the burning mill. He'd challenged by vox, using the day's code word, in case it was some of their own out of position and crossing the line of battle. No identifiers came back. Rilke lined up his long lads and began firing. Others in Collier's formation joined in, Eslin and McCoyne over a broken wall near Rilke, Livara, Vivo, and Loglass from the windows of a livery, the loom girls Sina and Arilla from a foxhole to Collier's right. Laz and autofire began to ripple down the street at them. Platoon strength opposition, at least. Sina and Arilla formed, respectively, the gunner and loader of a heavy stubber team. They'd learned the skills in the Vervan War as part of one of the many scratch companies of the Resistance. Sina was a plump 25-year-old girl who wore a black slouch cap to keep her luxuriant bangs out of her eyes. Arilla was skinny, barely 18. Somehow it looked wrong for the frailer, shorter girl to always be the one lugging the hollow plasteel yoke laden with ammo hoppers. But they were an excellent team. Their matte black stubber was packed into the lip of the foxhole tightly to prevent the tripod skating out during sustained fire. Those old pattern stubbers could buck like a riled auroch. Sina was squirting out tight bursts, interspersing them with longer salvos that she sluiced from side to side on the gun stand's oiled gimbal. Eslin and McCoyne tossed out a few tube charges that detonated with satisfying thumps and collapsed the street facade of a farrier's shop. Collier got a few shots off himself, moving along the defense line. Another anti-tank round screamed low overhead. Collier hoped the infantry clash would bring the half-track up in support of its troops. He got Loglass and Vivo to prep their missile tube.
9. 17.
17, Merrin answered over the link.
What have you got? Access to the next street. Looks quiet. Advancing. Steady does it. Keep in vox touch.
A particularly heavy spray of lasfire stippled the wall behind him, and Collier ducked flat. He heard the stubber barking out in response.
9. 32.
Reading you, 9.
Any luck with that half-track yet, Bonin?
We're crossing the waste ground. Can't find a route back onto the street to come in behind them.
Hold on. Collier tensed as he heard fierce shooting distorted by the vox.
32. 32.
We fire. Heavy fire in this area. Feth, we've got
Bonin's response came back, chopped by the vox bounce off the buildings.
9. 32. Say again. 9. 32.
The channel just bled white noise. Collier could hear staccato crossfire from behind the structures to his right. Bonin's fire team needed help. More particularly, if they were overrun, Collier needed to make sure the gap to his flank was plugged.
9. I require fire support here. Map mark 51.33.
Within 2 minutes, a platoon had moved up from the warehouses along the route his team had already cleared.
Collier's old friend Sergeant Haller was at the head of it. Collier quickly outlined the situation and the suspected position of the N-20 to Haller, and then grouped up a fire team of Livara, Eslin, McCoyne, and, from Haller's detail, Trooper Search and a flamer man, Lubber.
"Take over here,"
Collier told Haller, and immediately led his ready team right, down through the breezeway and onto the open ground beyond. As if it had been waiting for the Vegastite hero to go, the half-track suddenly clanked forward through the pungent brown smoke and fired its main mount at the ghost line. Two of Haller's new arrivals were killed, and Loglas was wounded by flying debris. Haller ran head down through the rain of burning ash and scooped up the missile tube as Vivo got the dazed Loglas into cover.
"Loaded!"
Haller yelled at Vivo.
"Hell yes, sir,"
Vivo confirmed. Haller sighted up. He put the crosshairs on the box-armored view slits of the N-20's cab.
"Ease!"
The rocket tore open the half-track's cab armor like a can opener and exploded out with enough force to spin the entire anti-tank mount around. Cena and Arilla hosed the stricken machine with stubfire. There was a ragged ripple of cheers from the ghosts.
"Load me up again," Haller told Vivo. "I want to make certain and kill it twice."
Bonin's advance team had run into ferocious and extraordinary opposition, centering on a shell-damaged building at the edge of the waste ground. More than 20 Infardi weapons had fired on them, and then, incredibly, dozens of green-clad warriors had charged out, brandishing cleavers, pikes, and rifle bayonets. The five ghosts reacted with extreme levels of improvisation. Fenix had been winged in the initial fire, but he was still fit to fight, and dropped to his knees, presenting a smaller target as he fired at the mob rushing them. Weln and Venar had already fixed bayonets and countered directly, uttering blood-chilling yells as they drove forward, slashing and impaling. Bonin sprayed his lasgun on full auto, draining out the power cell swiftly, but harvesting the opposition. Jajo was carrying the loaded tread feather and decided not to waste the stopping power. Yelling, "Ease!" he shouldered the tube and fired the anti-tank round into the face of the building the Infardi had charged out of. The backblast took out several of the skirmishers and collapsed a section of the wall. Then Jajo tossed his tube aside and leapt into the close fighting, his silver blade in his hand. His power cell depleted, Bonin joined in the hand-to-hand too, clubbing with his gunstock. The Imperials, trained by the likes of Fagor and McColl at this sort of fighting, outclassed the cultists, despite the latter's superior numbers and bigger, slashing blades. But the Infardi had frenzy in them, and that made them lethal opponents. Bonin broke a jaw with a swing of his lasgun, and then smacked the muzzle of his weapon into the solar plexus of another attacker. What the feth had made them charge out like this, he wondered. It was bizarre, even by the unpredictable standards of the chaos-polluted foe. They had cover, and they clearly had guns. They could have taken Bonin's intruder unit in the open. The brutal melee lasted for 4 minutes, and only ended when the last of the Infardi were dead or unconscious. Bonin's team were all splashed with the enemy's gore, and the waste ground was soaked. Corpses sprawled all around. The ghosts had all sustained cuts and contusions. Bonin had a particularly deep laceration across his left upper arm, and Jajo had a broken wrist.
"What the hell was that about?"
Venar groaned, stooping over, out of breath. Bonin could feel the adrenaline surging through his body, the rushing beat of his own heart. He knew his team must be feeling the same way too, and wanted to use it before they ebbed out of that intense combat edge. He slammed a fresh power cell into his weapon.
"Don't know, but I want to know," he told Venner. "Let's get in there and secure the damn place fast. Jajo, use your pistol. Well, carry the tread feather."
Fenix suddenly switched round at movement behind them, but it was Collier's support section.
"Gak me,"
said Collier, looking at the bloody evidence of the fight.
"They charge you?"
"Like fething maniacs, sir," Bonin said, pausing to put a las round through the head of a stirring Infardi.
"From there?"
Bonin nodded.
"Protecting something," Eslan suggested.
"Let's find out," said Collier. "Fenix, get yourself and Jajo back to the rear and find medics. Bonin, Lubber, you've got point."
The 9 men advanced into the ruin through the hole Jajo's rocket had made. Lubber's flamer stuttered and then surged cones of fire into the dark spaces. They found the Infardi troop leader sprawled unconscious amid the blast damage. His personal force shield had been overwhelmed by the rocket blast, and the portable generator pack lay shattered nearby. He'd sent his men out in a suicidal charge to cover his own escape. Collier looked down at the unconscious man. Tall, wiry, with a shaved head and a pot belly, his unhealthy skin was covered with unholy symbols. Bonin was about to finish him with his silver blade, but
Kolia stopped him.
Box the chief. Ask him if he wants a prisoner.
In the next street over, Merrin's unit had caught up with McColl's scout section, and they moved forward together. The sounds of close fighting rolled in from the neighboring street, but Haller had informed Merrin that the N-20 had been killed and advised him to press on. Night was now falling fast, and the darkening sky was lit all around by firelight, the flashes of explosions and the glimmer of tracers. By McColl's guess, the fight was not yet even half done. The Tanith were still a long way from taking Bavnaga or securing their primary objective, the fuel depot. Strangely, the street they advanced down, a narrow lane lined with empty dwellings and plundered trading posts, was untouched by the fighting, intact, almost peaceful. McColl wished urgently for full darkness. This phase of the day, when light turned into night, was murder on the eyes. Night vision refused to settle in. The bright moons were up, shrouded by palls of rising smoke that turned them blood red. Merrin suddenly made a movement and fired. Swiftly, all the ghosts opened up, moving into secure cover. Odd bursts of gunfire came back at them, chipping the bricks and stucco walls of the commonplace buildings. Then something made a whooping bang, and a building to Merrin's left dissolved in a fireball that took two ghosts with it.
Armor! Armor!
Squatted ominous like a brooding toad, the AT-70 crumpled a fence as it rolled out onto the road, traversing its turret to fire down on them again. The blast destroyed another house.
"Missile tube to order!"
Merrin yelled, as brick chips drizzled down over him.
"Firing jam! Firing jam!"
"Feth!" Merrin growled. The one tool they had that might make a dent in the tank was down. They were caught cold. Infadi troops streamed in behind the Reaver, blasting away. A serious small-arms firefight developed, lighting up the dim street with its strobing brilliance. The tank rolled on, crashing heedlessly over the dead or wounded forms of its own foot troops. Merrin shuddered. It would soon be doing the same to his boys. From his position, he could hear McColl urgently talking over the vox. He waited until McColl broke off before patching in.
17, 4. Do we fall back?
4, 17. See if we can hold out a few minutes more. We can't let these infantry numbers in at our flank.
Understood. What about the tank?
Let me worry about that.
Easy for McColl to say, Merrin thought. The tank was barely 70 meters away now, its 105mm barrel lowered to maximum declension. It fired again, putting a crater in the road, and its coaxial weapon began chattering. Merrin heard two ghosts cry out as they were hit by the spray of bolter rounds. The Infadi troops were moving up all around. This was turning into a full-on counter-thrust. Merrin wondered what the Feth McColl intended to do about the tank. He hoped it wasn't some insane suicidal run with a satchel of tube charges. Even McColl wouldn't be that crazy, would he? Then again, he hoped McColl had something up his guard-issue sleeve. The AT-70 was going to be all over them in a moment. His vox crackled.
Infantry units, brace and cover for support!
What the Feth? A horizontal column of light, as thick as Merrin's own thigh, raked down the narrow street from the rear. It was so bright its afterimage seared Merrin's retinas for minutes afterwards. There was a stink of ozone. The AT-70 blew up. Its turret and main gun, spinning like a child's discarded rattle, separated from the hull in the fireball and demolished the upper story of a house. The hull itself split open like a roasting nalnut shell in a campfire and showered flames and metal fragments everywhere.
"Feth me,"
Merrin stammered.
"Moving up, stand aside,"
the vox said. Le Guin's grey venger rolled up the street, a dark, predatory shape, unlit.
"Drinks are on me," Merrin heard McColl vox to the tank.
"Hold you to that. Form up and follow me in. Let's get this finished."
The ghosts moved out of cover and ran up behind the advancing tank destroyer, firing suppression bursts into the surrounding houses. The venger crunched over the remains of the Reaver. The Infadi were in flight. Merrin smiled. In a second, the flow of battle had completely reversed. Now they were the ones advancing with a tank. Half a kilometer away, the heart of destruction and the P-48J finally broke through into the marketplace. Their steady advance had been delayed for a while by a trio of N-20s, and the heart's hull carried the blackened scars of that clash. Cleopas looked away from the prismatic upscope for the first time in what seemed like hours.
"Load?"
he asked.
"Down to the last 20,
his gunlayer said after checking the shells left in the water-jacketed magazine. Small arms fire began to rattle off the mantlet. Cleopas scoped around and identified at least 3 fire teams of Infadi troops on the northern side of the marketplace.
The two conquerors smashed forward through the empty wooden market stalls, shattering them and tearing off the canvas awnings. P-48J dragged one like a pennant. The Hearts gun team loaded and laid at one of the enemy fire teams.
"Don't waste a shell on soft targets, we're low on ammo,"
Cleopas growled. He pulled open a fire control lever and aimed up the coaxial bolter. The heavy cannon destroyed one infantry position in a blizzard of dust. The P-48J followed suit. She must be running low on shells too, Cleopas decided darkly, and between them, the armored pair pulverized the outclassed foot troops. Cleopas's Auspex suddenly showed two fast-moving blips.
A pair of Urdeshi-made light tanks, Steg Fours, each bouncing along on three pairs of massive tires, spared into the square, headlamps blazing. Their tiny turrets mounted only stick-like 40-mil cannons, but if they had tungsten cord ammo or discarding sabots, they might still hurt the hefty Imperial machines.
"Lay up on that one,"
said Cleopas, indicating his backlit target screen as he checked the upscope.
"Now we use our muscle."
Sergeant Baffles felt he was under intense pressure to perform. He was sweating profusely, and he felt sick. The ferocious combat was bad enough, but he'd seen plenty of that before. It was the command responsibility that troubled him. His eastern prong of the infantry assault had pushed up through Bavnaga far enough to cross the main highway. Now, with the temple on their right, they fought through the streets north of the market towards the fuel depot. Gaunt himself had charged Baffles with clearing the route to the depot. He would not fail, Baffles told himself. The Colonel Commissar had given him squad command on Vergast. He didn't want it much, but he appreciated the honor of it every waking moment. Now Gaunt had tasked him with the battle's crucial phase. It was an almost impossibly heavy burden to carry. Almost 1,000 ghosts were pouring into the town behind him, platoon supporting platoon. The original plan had been that they, and a similar number under Kolia, would drive open parallel wounds into Bavnaga's defenses and crack the place wide, while Rawn took the northern depot. Now, with both Kolia and Rawn basically bogged down, it was down to him. Baffles thought about Kolia a lot, usually with envy tinging his mood. Kolia, the great war hero, took to command so effortlessly. The troops loved him. They would do anything for him. To be fair, Baffles had never seen a trooper disobey one of his own orders, but he felt unworthy. Until Vervenhide, he'd been a common dog soldier, too. Why the feth should they do as he told them? He thought about Milo, too. Milo, his friend, his squad buddy. Milo should have had this command, he often thought. Baffles's brigade had struggled up through the streets east of the market, winning every meter hard. Baffles had Commissar Hark with him, but he wasn't sure Hark helped much. The men were afraid of him, and suspected him of all sorts of dreadful motives. It was good to have a healthy fear of commissars, Baffles knew that much. That's what commissars were there for, and the regiment's new commissar, give him his due, was doing his job, and doing it well. As he had proved the day before during the ambush, Hark was almost unflappable, and he had a confident and agile grasp of field tactics. Not only was he urging the rear portions of Baffles' group on, he was directing and focusing their efforts in a way that entirely complemented the sergeant's lead. But Baffles could tell that the men despised Hark, despised what he stood for. Baffles knew this because it was how he felt himself. Hark was Lugo's agent. He was here to orchestrate Gaunt's demise. The leading edge of Baffles' assault had run into especially fierce fighting at an intersection between the abandoned halls of an Isholi school and the market's livestock pens. Despite monumental efforts by Sorek's platoon, they had lodged tight, coming under heavy fire from N-20 half-tracks and several curious six-wheeled light tanks. Hark, picking out a squad of Nen, McKendrick, Rice, Vully, Muril, Tokar, Kaun, and Garond, had attempted to leapfrog Sorek's unit and break the deadlock. They found themselves pinned down almost immediately. Then, more by luck than plan, Pardus armor tore up through the eastern roadway to support them. The executioner Strife, the conquerors Tread Softly, and Old Strontium, the destroyer Death Jester. Between them, they made a terrific mess of the northeastern streets and left burning tank and light tank carcasses in their wake. Baffles moved his forces in behind them as they made the last push to the depot, just a few streets away. It had been bloody and slow, but Baffles had done what Gaunt had asked of him. The delay had given Gaunt himself the opportunity to move up with the front. Baffles was almost overjoyed to see him, and Hark immediately deferred to the Colonel Commissar. Gaunt approached Baffles' position as enemy lasfire crisscrossed the night air.
You've done a fine job, Gaunt told the sergeant.
It's taken Fethin ages, I'm afraid, sir,
Baffles countered.
It was going to. The Urshul aren't giving up without a fight.
Urshul, sir?
A word Ayatani Zwile taught me this afternoon.
Smell that?
I do, sir,
said Baffles, scenting the stink of Promethean fuel on the wind.
Let's go finish it, Gaunt said.
Supported by the blistering firepower of the Pardus, the ghosts moved forward towards the depot. Leading one line, Gaunt found himself suddenly face to face with Infadi, who had laid low and dug in, now springing out in ambush to the file. His power sword sang, and his bolter spat. Around him, Uril, Hargion, Sorik, and Lillo, some of the best of the Vergastite new blood, proved themselves worthy ghosts. It was the first of 17 separate hand-to-hand engagements the Prong would encounter on the way up. At the fifth, a messy firefight to clear a cul-de-sac, chance brought Gaunt and Hark up side by side in the mayhem. Hark's plasma pistol seared into the shadows.
I'll say this, Gaunt. You fight a good fight.
Whatever. The Emperor protects,
Gaunt murmured, decapitating a charging Infadi with the power sword of House Sondar.
You still don't trust me, do you?
Hark said, destroying an enemy stub nest with a single, volatile beam.
Are you really very surprised?
Gaunt replied tartly, and without waiting for a response, rallied his ghosts for the next assault. Sergeant Bray was the first platoon leader in Baffles' group to break his men through to the fuel depot proper. He found a row of massive sheds and chubby fuel tanks, guarded by over 100 dug-in Infadi, supported by 3 AT-70s and a pair of usurpers. Bray's rocket teams got busy. This was the heaviest resistance they'd yet encountered, and the attack had hardly been a picnic up until then. Bray called up for armor support. Gaunt, Baffles, Sorik, and Hark clawed in, each driving a solid formation of ghosts up to the rear of Bray's position. Gaunt could taste victory, and defeat too, intertwined. Experience told him that this was the moment, the make or break. If they endured and pushed on, they would win the town and destroy the foe. If not, shell, las, and hard round fire whipped into his formation. He saw the Pardus go forward, smashing through chain-link fences and across ditches as they breached the depot compound. Strife killed a usurper, and Death Jester crippled a reaver. The night sky was underlit by a storm of explosions and tracers.
Regroup! Regroup!
Baffles was yelling as the shells scourged the air. Sorik's section made gains, charging in through the southern fence, before being driven back by heavy fire from Infadi troops. Hark's section was backed into a corner. Gaunt saw the Baneblade before anyone else. His blood ran cold. 300 tons of super-heavy tank, a captured, corrupted Imperial machine. It trundled casually out from behind the depot, its massive turret weapon rising. A monster. A steel-shod monster from the mouth of hell.
Baneblade! Enemy Baneblade at 61.78!
Gaunt yelled into his vox. Captain Wall, commanding the old Strontium, couldn't believe his ears. His Auspex picked up the behemoth a second before it fired, and obliterated the Conqueror tread softly. Wall laid in and fired, but his tank round barely made a dent on the massive machine's hull. The Baneblade's secondary and sponson turrets began to fire on the Imperial positions. The immediate death toll was hideous. Staunch, loyal ghosts broke in terror and ran as the Baneblade rolled forward.
"Stand true! Stand true, you worthless dogs!"
Hark yelled at the fleeing Tanith around him.
"This is the Emperor's work! Stand true or face his wrath at my hand!"
Hark was suddenly jerked backwards as Gaunt seized his wrist tightly and spoiled the threatened aim of his plasma pistol.
"I punish the ghosts. Me. Not you. Besides, it's a fething Baneblade, you moron. I'd be running too. Now, help me."
Sorek's and Bray's sections hurled anti-tank missiles at the looming giant, to no great avail. Death Jester hit it with 2 blinding shots, and still it rolled on. The Infadi armor and infantry advanced behind it. Gaunt realized he had been right. This had been the moment, the make or break. And they had broken. Weapons thumping and spitting, the Infadi Baneblade drove the Tanith first into abject retreat. Baffles would not let go. He was still determined to prove Gaunt right in selecting him for command. He was going to win this. He was going to take the target. He was... As men fled around him, he grabbed a fallen tread feather, loaded up a rocket, and took aim on the monster tank.
It was less than 20 meters away now, a giant, fire-spitting dragon that blotted out the stars. Baffles locked the crosshairs on a slit window near what he assumed was the driver's position. He held the tube steady and fired. There was a bright blast of flame, and for one jubilant moment Baffles thought he'd been successful, that he'd become a hero like Fething Golcolia. But the Bane Blade was barely bruised. One of its secondary coaxial cannons killed Baffles with a brief spurt of shots. Rorn's counterpunch finally reached the Bavnaga Temple at 9:35. It was dark by then, and the town was alive with firestorms and shooting. Their slow progression through the minefield had sped up when Larkin and Domor had hit upon an improvised plan. Domor's augmetic eyes could pick out many mines just under the soil surface. He talked Larkin onto them, and Larkin and Banda then set them off with pinpoint shots. The sweepers had advanced another 30 meters, and by that time, with the sun gone, Cyrus's tank mob had dealt with the opposition armor. Then the tanks rolled in down the channel Domor had cleared and lowered their combat dozer blades to clear the last few meters now they were no longer under fire. The temple was a mess. Golden fish-scale tiles trickled off the burst dome of the once glorious stupa. Incendiary shells burned in the main nave. Prayer flags smoldered and twitched in the breeze. The counterpunch drove in at last towards the fuel depot from the east. Captain Cyrus, his tracks now repaired, thundered forward in the wrath of Padua. He had heard the strangled, unbelievable transmission from the southern front that they'd met a Baneblade. If it was true, he wanted a piece of that, something Wall could never beat. The wrath of Padua came at the enemy Baneblade in the open space of the depot field. Sensing the wrath by Auspex, the Baneblade had begun to turn. Cyrus loaded auger shells, armor busters, into his breech, and punched two penetrating holes in the massive enemy's tank mantlet. Few Pardus tank commanders carried auger shells as a matter of course, because few ever expected to meet something genuinely tougher than themselves. Cyrus was a philosophically tactical man. He was happy to sacrifice a few valuable places in his magazine for auger shells, just in case. Now the trick was to target the holes made by the augers and blow the enemy out from the inside with a high-X tank round. The wounded Baneblade traversed its turret, locked onto the wrath of Padua, and destroyed it with a single shot from its main weapon. Cyrus was laughing in victory as he was incinerated. An instant of success all tank masters dream of. He had wounded the beast. He could die now. The wrath of Padua exploded, skipping armor chips out around itself in the blast wake. Old Strontium purred out from behind the shattered buildings south of the depot. Wall had never carried auger rounds as standard, like Cyrus. But he was damn well going to use the advantage. Ignoring his auspex and sighting only by eye, referring to his rangefinder and crosswind indicator, Wall punched a high-X shell through one of the profound holes Cyrus had made in the Baneblade's armor. There was a brief pause. Then the super-heavy tank blew itself to pieces in a titanic eruption of heat and noise and light. Gaunt and Sorik, with the help of Hark and the squad leaders, managed to slow the ghosts' panic and bring them around towards the fuel depot. Sorik himself led the charge back down the yard towards the depot, past the flaming remains of the Baneblade. By then, Rorn's counterpunch had chased in after the valiant wrath of Padua, and was cleaning out the last infardi in the depot. It was a running gun battle, and Rorn knew he had time to make up. He vox-signaled seizure of the depot just before 11. Surviving infardi elements fled north into the rainwoods beyond Bavnaga. The town was now in Imperial hands. As the medics moved around him in the smoke-stained night, Gaunt found Ayatani Zwile kneeling over the ruptured corpse of Sergeant Baffles. Sergeant Val stood attentively nearby, watching.
"Sorry, Chief," he insisted. "He wanted to be here," Val told Gaunt.
Gaunt nodded. "Thanks for looking after him, Val." Gaunt walked over to Zwile.
"This man is a special loss," Zwile said, turning to rise and face Gaunt. "His efforts were crucial here."
"Did someone tell you that, or do you just feel that, Father?"
"The latter. Am I wrong?"
"No, not at all." Baffles led the way to the depot. He did his duty, beyond his duty. I could not have asked for more. Zwile closed Baffles' clouded eyes.
"I felt as much. Well, it's over now," he said. "Sleep well, Pilgrim. Your journey's done."
Chapter 11 The Rainwoods. Though my tears be as many as the spots of rain falling in the Hagian woods, one for every fallen soul loyal to the throne, there would not be enough. Gospel of Saint Sabbat, Psalms 2:7. Under cover of darkness, the sky lit up, over 150 kilometers away. Flashes, sudden flares, spits of light, accompanied by the very distant judder of thunder. Once it had been going on for an hour, they all agreed it wasn't a storm.
Full-scale action, Corbeck murmured. That's one feth of a fight, Bragg agreed.
They stood in the dark, at the edge of the Holy River, insects chorusing around them, as Greer and Dar worked on the engine.
What I wouldn't give, Derren began, and then shut up.
I know what you mean, son, said Corbeck.
Bavnaga,
said Milo, joining them with a flashlight and an open chart slate.
Where, boy?
Bavnaga, farming town,
and the approach to the foothills. Milo showed Corbeck the area on the chart.
It was meant to be our second night stop, he said. There's a fuel depot there.
An especially big flash underlit the clouds.
Feth,
said Bragg.
Bad news for some poor bastard, said Derren.
Let's hope it was one of theirs, said Corbeck.
Jordan had walked away down to the river and stood casting stones aimlessly into the inky water. He started as someone came up beside him in the close dark. It was the Isholi Sanian.
You are no fighter, I know that, she said.
What? I worked with the Lady Kerth. I saw you. A medic.
That's me, girl,
Jordan smiled.
You are old.
Oh, thanks a bunch. No.
You are old. On Hagia, that is a mark of respect.
It is. It shows you have wisdom, that if you haven't wasted your life, you have used it to collect up learning.
I'm pretty sure I haven't wasted my life, Sanian. I feel like I have.
He looked round at her. She was a shadow, a silhouette staring down into the river.
What? What am I? A learner? A student? All my life I have studied books and gospels, and now my world ends in ruin and war. The saint doesn't watch over us. I see men like Corbeck, Dower, even a young man like Bryn. They scold themselves because all they have learned is the art of war. But war is what matters. Here, on Hagia, now. But for the art of war-making, there is nothing.
There's more to life than...
There is not, Doctor. The Imperium is great. Its wonders are manifold. But what of it would remain but for war? Its people? Its learning? Its culture? Its language? Nothing. War encompasses all. In this time, there is only war.
Norden sighed. She was right. After a fashion.
War has found Bavnaga,
she remarked, looking briefly at the flashes underlighting the distant clouds.
You know the place,